The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
And now about our special guest. After more than 40 years of interviewing heads of state, world leaders, movie stars, criminals, murderers, inspirational figures, and celebrities of all kind, Barbara Walters has turned her gift for examination onto herself to reveal the forces that shaped her extraordinary and exciting life. Written with candor and flair, Audition reveals the private thoughts of a news media pioneer known as the first female network news co-anchor, the host and producer of countless top-rated specials, the star of 2020, and the creator and co-host of my wife's favorite show, The View. She has not only interviewed the world's most fascinating figures, she has also become an important part of their world. We are deeply honored to have Barbara Walters here with us tonight. After conducting hundreds of interviews herself, we're going to turn the tables on her a little bit and have her interviewed by one of our own. Joining her on stage is Tamela Edwards, 6ABC Action News Morning Edition co-anchor. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome me in joining Barbara Walters and Tamela Edwards to the City Main Stage.
Good afternoon. We're going to pause for 30 seconds to let our friends in the news media get a picture. So we'll be quiet for a moment.
My phony smile, don't ask it.
All right. And now I've got a personal request from Barbara, which is, I notice a lot of you have your cameras. I know you want to grab a picture. Once we get started, please let's not do that. It's sort of a popcorn of flashes, and it can be a little bit distracting. So in about 5 seconds, we're going to get started. And hopefully all cell phones, all photos, and everything will be done.
Thank you.
First of all, you must hear this all the time, but indeed it is true. It is quite an honor to get to talk to you. When I heard 600 pages, I wondered, what must that be like? And then you read the book, and you realize that every page is worth it, and it is well worth the time to spend reading it.
Thank you.
And in the book, you say one of the key ways that you began to get newsmakers to talk to you is you would say, aren't you misunderstood? Give me an opportunity.
Well, not exactly. I don't say what I have found. First of all, let me thank all of you for coming on this rainy, I think the weather cleared up a little bit, but 5 o'clock on a Sunday, to have so many of you come out to see Tam and me. Is for me a great honor. When we do The View, we have an audience, but I don't get to talk to everybody or see everybody. So I do want to say this is very special for me. So, and I can see all of your faces. I can see when you fall asleep. I can see when you yawn. So very often people don't want to answer certain questions, and you don't want to be rude. I mean, there is a way you hope of kind of getting around it. So what I have often said was, what's the greatest misunderstanding about you? And then very often they will say whatever the thing is that you were afraid to ask. So it's a good question. You can even ask it at a dinner party. Everybody feels to some degree that they're slightly misunderstood, and most often we are, which is one of the reasons that I wrote this.
Right. Indeed, you say in the beginning that you would tell people, if you want my life, you have to take everything, the good and the bad. But I figure, what a great question, what a wonderful way to start. Barbara Walters, what is the greatest misunderstanding about you?
Well, I think what I said in the beginning of the book was that when young people, especially young women in journalism, my life seems so wonderful and glamorous, and it's all been up, up, up. And it is that. I mean, I am blessed. I couldn't have written this book if I were not in a very good place in my life. If there's any good thing about getting older, it's that eventually, if you're lucky, you reach that place. But I said, okay, if you want my life, then you have to take the whole package. and the package includes a sister who was considered mentally retarded, a father famous in show business, had the greatest nightclubs in America, who had huge ups and downs and a very, very difficult and sad ending, or not ending, but period in his life, my own failures, because I was a huge failure when I came to ABC, and all of that. But I think the misconception is that my life was perfect, and that I was sort of cold and authoritative, because I did 20-20 for 25 years. And when you're in a position and you're asking questions and so on, people don't think that you've bled. And I can't really be close to anyone who hasn't bled. So I think the view helped. As my daughter said at last month, people thought, you know, well, thank God she's got a sense of humor. But up until then, I think I seemed very cold and rather forbidding.
You mentioned in the book one of your interviews with Oprah Winfrey, when she talks about all the terrible things that happened in her childhood, but she said, I felt that I was destined for greatness, essentially. There was something greater out there for me. You start the book talking a lot about your childhood, all the moves back and forth, the search, auditioning for friends, auditioning in new schools. If someone had met you at 10, at 15, what would you have guessed you were destined for? What would you have said?
Well, if they had met me at 10 or 15, I probably then was living in Florida in a pistachio green house on an island, huge mansion, on an island with the Latin Quarter on one side and this house that came with the Latin Quarter on the other. I would have been a rather introverted, a shy child with very dark hair. I know you're going to be upset to find out that this is not my... and I would be sitting in the lighting booth of the Latin Quarter, watching the shows every night, the big glamorous shows. I can, with two glasses of wine, I'll do Milton Berle's entire act for you. And at the time, I had no idea what I wanted to be. I didn't start in television. I started as a writer. I didn't start in the Today Show until I was in my mid-30s. So I think, you know, there's always time for us to change and start again. I've seen that happen so much. But at 9 or 10, I don't know, an actress maybe. But there weren't that many, you know, there weren't that many great choices. I'd be married. I'd have children. They'd be like me, shy and lonely.
You write a lot about the relationships with your family. Mm-hmm. And the one that really stood out to me a lot was a lot about what you wrote about your mother, that the life was tough on her, packing up and moving, catering to your father, taking care of your sister. And just the story of Angel the dog, this poor little dog that's scared of everything, and the two of them walking down the street, or her sitting there in front of the television. You write about feeling sad, about feeling guilt. Did you ever get angry as somebody who multiple times said, this relationship isn't working for me, or who saw other women do that? Did you ever wish he had said, hold it, I don't like this?
Well, I did to a degree. You know, people have asked me so much about my father and so much about my sister. It sort of pleases me that you ask me about my mother, because I love my mother very much. And my mother had a very tough life. I mean, my parents had a son before I was born who died. Then my sister, as I said, who was in those days mentally retarded when people did not understand it. Maybe she was autistic. We never knew the word. And she never could live alone. She never left my mother's side. My father with his career, ups and downs. This was very hard on my mother. We sometimes don't think of, we think of the husband, but we don't so often think of the wife. The only time I think, well, my advice usually about a job, especially for women, is get in there and don't whine. Do your job. Get there before anybody else. Make yourself so necessary that you climb that way. But when I was at ABC, at NBC, after Hugh Downs left, and I loved Hugh Downs, and he put me on the air. I was an accident. I'd never thought I'd be in front of the cameras. There was a man named Frank McGee, whom I write about, who had been anchoring the evening news, and they put him on the Today Show, and he hated it. He hated it, and he sure didn't want me. And he decided that he had to ask the questions himself. I was just a girl. And it went all the way up to the president. I mean, this sounds like I'm talking about another era. The president of NBC, to make certain that I didn't ask any of the questions. And that's any of the hard news questions. I could do the fashion shows. And that's when I finally stood up and said, I've been here for 9 years. You know, you can't do this to me. And then the compromise was that he asked the first three questions, and I could come in on the fourth. So what I did then, because there are ways around things, I went out and got my own interviews. And if I did, and I filmed them, he wouldn't be in them at all. So that's when I did the first interview with Henry Kissinger and the first interview with Dean Rusk and the first interview with Jimmy Carter, etc. And in a way, that's when I became Barbara Walters. Some people thought it was wonderful, and some people thought I was a very pushy cookie, depending upon how you felt about a woman in that position.
When you write about your father, you write about the dreamer that he was in terms of show business and the grand shows he put on. You also write about the failures, one, in fact, that brought him to the point that he tried to take his own life.
Yes. I've never written or talked about that until this book.
And that's what I wanted to talk about, because you write so movingly about touching his face and, Daddy, Daddy, please stay, and very quickly figuring out, how do I hide this, and calling the gossip columnist and saying it was exhaustion. He passed some time ago. Why not until now did you decide to talk about this?
Well, there are many things I didn't talk about until this book. Some of them seem to have been more sensational than I would have imagined, but
we'll get to that.
No, we won't get to that, as a matter of fact, because as you know, I think I've talked enough about it. When I was growing up, I never saw my father that much, because when the Latin Quarter was open, which was about 20 years, first one in Boston, then in Florida, and then in New York, my father would get home 1, 2 in the morning and sleep until, you know, 12, 1 in the afternoon. And I didn't appreciate him, and I didn't love my life. I mean, I wanted a father who came home every night. I know, looking back, I think, wow, what a fascinating life I had. I knew every celebrity. That's why I'm not in awe of them, because I know that they have problems and difficulties like the rest of us. And it was only when things got so bad for my father, which if you read the book you will read about, when he attempted suicide, that I realized how much I loved him, how much he meant to me, how alike in so many ways. But he was a gambler and a risk taker, and I don't think of myself as that way. But as I said when I did this book, it's the whole package. It's my sister. It's my daughter whom I wrote about. And I said it was the hardest chapter of me to write about my daughter. But we did it. Jackie wanted it written because she said there are so many parents and grandparents and so forth who have children who are in difficulty and who are rebellious. And my daughter now runs a therapeutic wilderness program in Maine called New Horizons. Everything she put me through now, she has used for this. It's for adolescent girls in crisis. So that was a very hard chapter for me to write. The personal chapters were the most difficult. The heads of state, the presidents. I've interviewed every president since Richard Nixon. The murderers, Monica Lewinsky. Rubbing noses with the Dalai Lama. I mean, those were great. Fun to go back and look back at those interviews. And I never kept a diary, so I can't remember exactly how I felt, but I had all of the interviews. If I'd kept a diary, the book would be 2,200 pages long.
I want to ask you about fear, because you get to the Today Show and a contract that's for 13 weeks goes to 13 years. You leave, you go to ABC, you've spoken about Frank McGee and how terrible, your dad on the phone every night asking you how it's going. But you turn everything around. You have these specials. You have these interviews. And yet, as I read the book, I got the feeling that there was always a sense of fear. The bottom could fall out at any time, no matter how good things were. What did it take for you to get to a point to feel like, I'm good, nobody can take this from me?
You know, that's so funny, because I was just talking to my daughter about it this morning, because my daughter marches to her own drummer, as they say. I just have to tell you something funny about my daughter, because she's on my mind. My daughter's adopted. I think most people know that now. And we adopted her when she was 4 days old. And she had her problems being adopted. And she feels that many adopted children have what she calls a black hole in their heart, because they feel unfinished. And we were talking today about when you can finally accept yourself. In my case, I'll tell you the story maybe when we end it, but I feel I finally have, and so has she. And at one point, because she never wanted to find out who her biological mother was. So I said to her one day when she was in her 20s, my daughter's going to have a big birthday next month. And I said, Jackie, do you want me to help you find... By the way, my daughter is named after my sister, who was alive when I named my daughter, which gives you some idea of the relationship. I wanted my sister to feel that she had a baby too. Anyway, so I said to my daughter, would you like me to find your biological mother? If you want me to, darling, I will help you. I'll look for your biological mother. And she said, I've had so much trouble with you. Why would I want another one? So that's Jackie. Now I forgot the question.
I was asking about fear, and
fear.
What did it take
well,
you to
my
get to
father
that
said that I was born under a halo of fear because we had so much. We lived from the time I was about 6 or 7. My father had been a booking agent before that, and when vaudeville came out, that killed his business. And he opened this nightclub with the last 63 cents in his pocket, gave it to the waiter, and said, now we start from scratch. But we always felt, I always felt that there were ups and downs in show business. I always, in the back of my mind, thought, he's going to lose it, and I'm going to end up, as I did, supporting my mother, my father, my sister, and my child. And my father would call me up, as you said, and say, do they like you? Do you still have a job? And so I was constantly auditioning, and I swore that I would never marry anybody in show business. And I did. And one of them was a man who was the father of my child. So I used to spend a good deal of time here. His name was Lee Goober, and he ran places called Music Fair. There was one in Valley Forge, and there was one in Cherry Grove. So I spent a lot of time at a certain point in Philadelphia, and en rouge, as they say. But I always had the feeling that it could be over, and especially when you're in television. I mean, I've been doing this now. Well, I already told you how old I was, that I was in my 30s when I began, and I've been doing this for more than 45 years, so it's hard for me to say that I'm 62, isn't it? But I always lived under this feeling that it could all be over.
And does that feeling remain with you, or when did it go
away?
Well,
now I will tell you the story. I was sitting the other night with a man who was the head of MGM, and he said, you know, big position. And he said, when do you stop auditioning? And I said, well, you'll know when the time comes when you no longer need to. I had a very dear friend who unfortunately died last year, and I miss her very much, named Beverly Sills, who was one of the great sopranos. And when Beverly left singing, her husband gave her a ring, gold ring that had a sort of flat plate on the top that had an inscription. And when Beverly then, 10 years later, left the New York City Opera, she took the ring off her finger and she gave it to me. And the ring said, I did that already. And that's the way I feel now. So now I can write this book and be, I almost think, too honest. And I can stop auditioning. I'm in a very good place. I don't want to climb any more mountains. I love doing The View. I love those women. It's dessert now. You know, we finished our roller coaster years, I hope. And I have great pleasure. But I did that already. I don't need to audition anymore.
In reading about the many people you interviewed, even difficult people, you find a way to get on their wavelength and almost find some sort of humanity that seems to draw them ultimately to the camera, or a way to reach out to them, whether it's O.J. or Saddam Hussein.
No, I do not reach out to O.J.
Well, O.J. called you. There was a back and forth, and O.J. kind of gives you a hard time, and you're like, are you going to do this interview or not? And he tells you some things, but he never sits down for the interview. And I just
wondered, always wanted money. We would never do that.
But I wondered, was there somebody who, when you were done with the interview, you just had a revulsion, or you just went to reach
well,
out
you
and
know,
strangle?
When I do interviews, especially I've done so many interviews in the Middle East, when I'm doing an interview, I try not to be judgmental, and I don't give my own opinions. I don't think anybody knows my political opinion in the middle of this campaign, even though there isn't a day in The View when the political opinions of the other cast members are not discussed. So I am, when I'm doing an interview, I'm not judgmental, and I have no fear. I'm a wonderful editor. I know just the way things should go. In my private life, I can't decide whether to wear the yellow jacket or should I have worn the black suit. It's a different kind of feeling. when I interview murderers, and I have interviewed almost every of our time, from the man, Mark David Chapman, who killed John Lennon, to the Menendez brothers, my favorite line, when Eric Menendez said, "I'm just a normal boy, Bob," and Miss Walters, "I'm just a normal boy, Miss Walters." And I said, "Eric, you're a normal boy who killed your mother and father." You know, I'm not judgmental when I do it. When I get out, I realize the horror of it. But I don't, I come on and I listen to them. And I listen to them as someone who's not attacking them. And that makes a difference. And I think it makes a difference in your everyday life. And I listen. As I've said, it's not the first question. It's the second question. It's, what did you mean by that? Why did you say that? And most of these people, dictators or murderers or celebrities, want to be heard. They have a story they want to tell. And they need to know that you want to listen. Now, after that, you can say whatever you want. And we do, you know, in the way we describe them and the way we edit and so on. Once in a while in The View, we get, you know, we will show how we feel. But I very rarely do.
You write about going from the heights of morning television to sitting next to Harry Reasoner and how difficult that was. And I think it will remind a lot of people of someone who they see going through a difficult transition today, which would be Katie Couric. Mm-hmm. You had your specials. That was your saving grace, your interviewing skills. What would you say to her? Because she doesn't have the specials.
I've talked to Katie. One of the differences is that I had a partner who really didn't like me. It's not that he didn't like me, because eventually Harry Reasoner wrote his own autobiography and I did the interview with him. He was doing the show alone. He didn't want a partner. He certainly didn't want a girl. It was a come-down. And when I walked into that studio and no one talked to me, because all the cameramen, the stagehands and so forth were Harry's people, night after night, and I knew that I was failing. I mean, I read it in every paper, and I was then supporting the whole family. I thought I was drowning. And what saved me was letters, especially from women, not women in television, who said, "Hang in there, we're going through this too. If you make it, any of us can make it. I at least try." Now, with Katie, she came with great, you know, love from NBC when she went to CBS. When I left NBC, they were really quite awful to me because they never expected me to leave, to a very supportive environment. But it's been extremely difficult for Katie. And I've talked to her, and Katie's a very fine reporter, and she's going to be okay. There will be other avenues for Katie if she wants them. But I know how she's feeling. And I said to her, "You're sorry that you left the Today Show," because it took me years before I didn't say, "Why did I leave? Why did I leave?" And she said, no, she never regretted that it was time for her to make a move. So I think that's something that must sustain her. Katie's going to be okay. Katie's a very good reporter. We're in very different times now than we were. There are lots of outlets, and that makes it both more difficult to make a name for yourself and easier, because there are so many different areas now that the women and men can go into.
In the book, you write, as you jokingly said one day, I believe it was on The View, about your lovers. And you write about Ace Greenberg and Alan Greenspan and other people who you respect.
Are you
and
trying
admire.
To slide into a question?
Yep.
Yeah. Why don't you just ask the question?
Did you stay friends with Ed Brooke? And if not, he seems to be the only person I can't tell. Everybody else, there's
a
friendship.
Well, the reason that Ed Brooke emerged so much, when you read the book, if any of you have read it, it's 4 pages out of 600. But when I was being interviewed by Oprah, which was taped 10 days in advance, Oprah released just that section. So, and the book was embargoed, so nobody could read it and see that there were so many other people and other aspects of it. And so that's all anybody knew. Was, oh my goodness, she had this relationship, which I could easily have left out. But I put it in, and I'm really sort of sick of talking about it because I'm sure you've all heard it. But I put it in a sense, just because it was important in my life, as were Alan Greenspan, whom nobody asked me about, and Senator Warner, whom nobody asked me about, who called me just yesterday, as a matter of fact, wonderful Senator John Warner, because these were people who were important at certain times in my life, and also to show how different things were and how different our understanding was 31 years ago between an African-American man and a white woman, and it would have destroyed my career and his life as well. And today we have an African-American running for president. So I didn't just put it in because I was willing to discuss. Do you have the copy of the book? I was on Ellen the other day. Anybody see it? Okay. Thank you. Good for Ellen. So she was talking to me about it, and I said, if you open the book to the inside, you see all these names? See all these names in the back? These thousands of interviews. Well, what this is just some of the interviews I've done. But what I said to Ellen was, if you listen to what's been said, you wouldn't think that these were the interviews I've done. You would think these were the men I slept with.
You write in the book about...
My mother would be so proud.
You write in the book about the three men you were married to, and I've seen you say in interviews that marriage just didn't seem to agree with you. And I wondered, because you have some fabulous couples going back from college that you're friends with, when you're walking along the beach with Felix and Elizabeth Roy Hatton and Henry and Louise Grunewald, or you're hanging out with other couples, do you regret anyone, the relationship not working out, or do you get jealous?
Well, both of the two couples you mentioned, both of them are... Let's see, Felix has been divorced, Elizabeth has been divorced, Louise Grunewald has been divorced, and Henry Grunewald, who was the editor of Time magazine, is widowed, so we don't have those kinds of conversations. Part of what I write about in the book, and it's a frame or a strain or a theme that goes through the book, is that the difficulty, especially for a woman, of trying to balance a career and marriage and children. And I used to say you could do any two out of the three. Today I think you can do three because you have understanding husbands, although today you have many more single mothers. And that balancing act is something that we all feel guilt about and that we all struggle with. And I write about two women in particular, both of whom were named Hepburn. Catherine Hepburn, who said in an interview with me that she never wanted children. So easy to do imitations of Catherine Hepburn. That if she had a little Katie or a little Johnny and it was an opening night, she'd say, out of my way, out of my way. So her choice was not to have children, even though she lived with a married man, by the way, for many, many, many years, Spencer Tracy. He never divorced his wife, but she did not want children. Audrey Hepburn gave up her career because she had two sons, and she said she couldn't manage both. So a lot of this... when I talk about my marriage, and by the way, the reason that I had more than one marriage is that you didn't live with anyone then. Contrary to what we've talked about earlier, I mean, you wanted to be with someone, you marry them. Well, I didn't get married the first time until I was 23. It was a mistake. I left my parents' home and got married because 23 then was very old. I was the only one of my friends who wasn't married. And I think this balancing act that I went through and that so many women and men today, too, go through of how, you know, you want to be with your children. If you stay home and you don't work, and I think that women are so valuable when they stay home. They read more than I do. They do more charity work than I do, and so forth. But that comes a day when the kids go off to college and whatever, and you say, for this little brat, I've given up my, you know. On the other hand, if you work all the time, there is always that, should I be there, should I be there? My daughter, when somebody, Charlie Gibson, did a special on me, and he said to Jackie, well, didn't you mind your mother going away? She didn't even notice, because I was always there for every major event, every school play, which working mothers do. So one of the things I tried to do in this book is to say, these are some of the things that I went through, and you in your way are going through it too, and you can relate to this. And that is a central theme of this book, whether it's in my marriages or the career or the walks on the beach. It is something that goes through. The subtitle could not be audition. It should be guilt, because that's also the story of my life.
Is it something that you've made your peace with? So you're not married? There's plenty of people to date.
Oh, I don't want to get married now. No. Have I made my peace with it? Oh, yes.
You're sure?
But you see, that's the other thing, because when I was growing up, the idea of having a career like mine was almost unheard of. I mean, I didn't have that many mentors. And a woman was nothing if she didn't have a husband. And I could see when I was interviewing Lady Bird Johnson, for example, and talking to her about, you know, why she, you know, it was always Bird, he was always calling her from the other room, and she talked herself about what it was a different time and what it was like to be married to a very strong man. We are raising our daughters in a different way.
We see more women in the industry now, but what is your assessment? Do you think that a woman has as good a shot as a man to rise to the top in the news business, or it's still a little unequal?
Well, I think in front of the cameras now they certainly do. On the morning shows, I mean, there are so many women, and they're wonderful. I mean, Diane and Robin and Meredith, whom we're very proud of. And we have a tremendous number of women producers. We don't have any women as the head of a network. We have an executive vice president, but we haven't reached that top place yet. But it certainly is you know, in so many ways, wide open. The news department was, for a long time, was an all-boys network, and that's what affected me so much. I mean, how dare I even think that I could ask the serious question? How could I ever scoop Walter Cronkite by doing a joint interview with Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin? How could I ever have interviewed Fidel Castro? Obviously, he and I had a romantic relationship, you know, that kind of thing. It took me 25 years to get the next interview. It must have been quite a romantic relationship.
In the book, you write about talking to Rudy Giuliani shortly after 9/11, and I'm going to paraphrase, but he gives you a quote that courage is the best of human traits because everything else that's good follows from there. You've interviewed so many people and examined them from so many angles. What is the chief trait that you think is most valuable in an individual based on what you've seen?
In an individual?
In a person, what is the most important human trait?
Trying to accept yourself. I mean, courage is important, and honesty is important, and loyalty is important, and I would be lost without my friends. But most of us spend a lifetime trying to come to terms with ourselves. And if you can find that at whatever stage, it brings great peace of mind. That's why you see all these self-help books every other day, you know, how to get there, what to do, how to be it. And it's a very hard thing to find, and it's a matter of accepting all the good things that you've done in your life, which, as I said, I'm finally, you know, looking back. I was so busy working that I didn't have the time to really enjoy it. And I said this to Oprah, as a matter of fact, because nobody works harder than Oprah. And I talk about it in the book, too, of finding the time, whatever you're doing, to appreciate yourself.
All right. Well, wait.
I'll give you a little anecdote. There's a woman named Kitty Hart who died very recently. And she said that she used to, she was an actress and a singer and married to Moss Hart. And she said every night before she went to bed, she would look in the mirror at herself and she would say, "Kitty, I forgive you."
People should know that you titled the memoir Audition, not just because you felt like you were constantly auditioning in news divisions, but you felt like you were auditioning even from the time you were a child, for friends, for popularity, for self-acceptance, for so many different things. You mentioned in the book towards the end that you don't feel the need to audition in the work world anymore. Do you feel as though you're done with auditioning overall, or is that going to be with you till the end, probably?
No, but that's why I said my feeling now is I did that already. I felt that it came from a childhood because, and I was going to call this book Sister because she was the most influential figure in my life, but because she was shunned and made fun of and she stuttered so terribly people rejected her, that I felt, although I didn't know the word audition, that I had to find a place where I could be accepted, and I had this terrible guilt about her because I loved her, but I resented her. And so from the very earliest days in all aspects of my life, I felt I was auditioning. But I really don't know. I'm in a very happy place. I'm in a good place. I don't want to climb any more mountains. I still have a contract. I still have to do specials. Not have to. I want to. I enjoy them. I love to do The View. It's dessert. But I can also see a time when I will go to a city for more than one day. I went to Australia. I'd never been to Australia. I went to Australia for one day to do an interview with the widow of the crocodile hunter. One day. I went to China with Richard Nixon and spent the whole time in a broadcasting booth. I had to go back 3 years later just to see the Great Wall and to see China. So, you know, I feel that there's a time in my life now where I can do other things.
Well, that concludes my chance to talk to Barbara Walters. Now it is your chance. You'll notice that there are people in the aisles with microphones. We would ask that you wait till I'll acknowledge somebody. Wait till they bring the microphone over to you so that everybody can hear your question. And there's a woman right here who's about to pop out of her seat.
I wrote this out because I wanted to make sure I had it together. And it's a little bit of a three-part, but I'll say it pretty quickly. I think what I admire most about you is your awesome sense of responsibility and deep sense of caring for your family, which you felt at a very young age, and which seems to have been a driving force throughout your life, during which at various times you supported your mother, father, sister, and daughter. My first question is, where do you think that sense of responsibility and caring came from? Should I give you my other follow-ups?
How many do you have?
Two more.
Okay.
Where do you think that sense came from? And I know that we don't do this for praise, but did your mother, father, or sister ever have a chance to express to you gratitude for the role you played in helping them? And my final part was, now that they're gone, your parents and sister, do you feel more than just a loss, but kind of a losing that mission that you had?
Well, I don't know where the sense of responsibility came from, except that my mother, from a very young age, made me her confidant. And told me her problems. My father was away so much, and my sister. So that I felt, I think, that I never really had a childhood, because I was the closest one to my mother. So the responsibility came from a very young age. I forget the second question. I just remember the third. Did they have a chance? Well, my sister, whom I write about, who was, by the way, very pretty. Although I felt anger and resentment against her, she never seemed to feel it against me, which made it more difficult. So, no, I mean, my mother, when I was young, used to say, I wish I had six of you. I was a good baby. And my father always felt terrible that I was supporting him. And I would say, but, Dad, everything that I am, you made me. Don't feel that. I'm just giving back. And I think today, and I don't want to go through too much of it, but my parents and my sister are very much with me. I dream of them. They're very much a part of my life, and of my thoughts and of my guilt. And they were, when I was, as I said, when I was doing this book, I wanted to write about my family because I thought that I had such an interesting childhood from the glamour of it all and the nightclubs and so on. And I was going to end it there. And then the publisher said, no, you have to write about movie stars and murderers and celebrities coming out of rehab and so on. So, you know, there's so much of the book that's also that. But it's primarily a book about human relationships.
Maybe we'll take it in sections. Let's go to this woman right here on the left side. Go to the middle to the left.
I just want to thank you so much for your honesty and your forthrightness, and also to ask you, you mentioned that you were shy as a child, and I wondered how you overcame it.
Well, I think a lot of us are very different. There are actors who are very open, on, you know, when they're in front of the cameras. You'll read about my interview with Princess Grace, how different she was and why. And I think that somehow or other, when I'm in front of a camera or talking to all of you here, I'm totally comfortable. If I have to get up on a dance floor and dance without a partner, I can't do it. So we are all many things, and very rarely are our personalities all in one line.
What about this gentleman right here in the blue shirt with the beard?
Why don't you stand and let somebody come over to you?
Perhaps you cover this in the book, which I have not yet read, but how do you prepare yourself for these interviews?
Endlessly. I read almost anything I can. I mean, first of all, if you're doing a political interview or something, you just have to be up to date. You have to read newspapers and magazines. When I was on the Today Show, or even when I was doing 2020, and even today, I read three newspapers a morning. But beyond that, I do a great deal of homework. And then I prepare things on 3x5 cards. I can write 150 questions for an interview. I walk around and say, if you were going to interview Richard Nixon, what would you ask? Well, what would you, if you were going to talk to Monica Lewinsky, what would you ask? I ask everybody, and everybody has a question. My idea of hell is I finish, and someone comes up, the interview's done, the lights go down, the cameras leave, and someone says, did you ask us and such? And I think, oh, that's a question I forgot. Now, I probably do too much interviewing. And then I cut these questions down, I do them over. There are people who don't. Larry King prides himself on not reading the books. It makes it easier for him because he can ask the questions that he feels everyone wants to know. I was interviewed in radio yesterday by a man named Ron Owen in San Francisco. I said, did you happen to see the book? No. I mean, but he doesn't care because he feels that he asks the questions that he thinks most people want to know. We all have different techniques. I, even now in The View, do probably too much homework, but it makes me feel more secure. And especially when you're doing a long interview. Having written all these questions, I can then throw them away, but I have them. They're my security blanket.
This woman in the red jacket here.
I'd like to know about The View.
Hot. I'd like to know about The View, too. What can you explain?
I love to watch the hot topics, and I want to know what your limits are with the women. Sometimes they get so hostile with each other. Yeah. What are your limits on them tearing their hair out, like with Elizabeth Hasselbeck?
Yeah. Well, Elizabeth Hasselbeck is very important to this program, because there are very different, now we're in a political year, and it makes the program more interesting. But you have Joy, who is openly a liberal Democrat, who wanted, that kept asking for the president to be impeached. You have Oprah, and I think you know where Oprah comes from. And it's very important to have that other point of view. And Elizabeth does a lot of homework and has to maintain her point of view with everybody battling her. But it is with affection. When that light goes off in the camera, there is no antagonism among these women now. None. We appreciate each other, and we know that this is part of the territory, and we want it. I don't want everyone agreeing. Now, this was not always the case in the past, and it caused us some difficulties when it got to be personal. And I think it got to be personal with Rosie, who is very passionate about things and has a lot of, by her own admission, emotional issues, and we'll talk about them, and did on the program. Rosie has an enormous heart and is very lovable, but she has also, and she did have in the program, I think her opinions became all-engrossing. That was difficult. So it is easier for us now that we are off this roller coaster ride of feuds and so on. On the other hand, Rosie made for a very exciting program. So we never say to the women, you can't discuss that. We come in at 9 o'clock, the program's on at 11, we sit in the makeup room, and we have a list which was sent to our houses of, quote, hot topics, everything that's in the news from the celebrity to what the political is. And we choose the subjects that we're going to talk about. We don't talk about them too much. We don't want to leave them in the dressing room or any personal things that happen. When I come home, I will talk when I'm on about some of the reactions I got and so forth. But I never try to shut anybody up unless we're all talking all over each other. That drives me out of my mind.
Okay, I think it's a chance for somebody on this side. What about that gentleman right there on the aisle?
Hi, Barbara. Thank you for coming to see us today. This is tremendous, and your book is tremendous as well.
Thank you.
You've obviously interviewed some of the most famous and, I guess, infamous people that the world has known during your career. Is there anybody that you've missed, anybody you wanted to interview that you haven't been able to?
Yes. By the way, I read today when I got up, I had very nice news because I read that my book is number one here in Philadelphia. That's nice. That's a nice feeling. Well, there are certain people. The Queen never does interviews. I'd like to interview the Queen. You always want to do the interview with whoever is hard to get. It used to be a big coup to interview a president or a political candidate. Now they're on everything, so it's no coup. The Pope doesn't do interviews. That would be neither this one nor the last one. And when I say that I stopped auditioning and I don't want to climb any mountains, if Osama bin Laden called me, I would be packed. But it's the next one. When we do 10 Most Fascinating People, which is a special we do every year, you know, we're always looking for who is the person in this last year who has made the most impact in whatever field. And you're always looking for that next big quote, get.
The gentleman there in the back with the green sleeves, yes, and the black T-shirt, yes.
Excuse me. Thank you for coming, Ms. Walters. It's been truly a pleasure meeting you. I was just wondering, it seems like when I look on television, it seems like paparazzi or things like TMZ and YouTube, it seems to portray celebrities in a, I guess, an unfavorable way, and that seems how we get our information about celebrities these days instead of doing great interviews like you. What do you think about that? And my other question is, have you ever heard stories about, like, the civil rights movement or any civil rights leaders or pioneers or anything of that nature?
Well, the first question, which has to do with YouTube and TMZ, there's nothing anymore that's private. There's no relationship you can have that could be private. TMZ goes out of their way to be cruel. It's their way of getting viewers. It is very mean. And they've been very mean to me when I've been very pleasant for no reason. But that's the way they're getting ratings. So you sort of know that. And you either don't watch it or you just, you know, you just let it go. Have we ever done stories on civil rights leaders? I remember after Martin Luther King's assassination, interviewing and getting to know Mrs. King, talking to the children then who were very little. We've interviewed at that time a great many of the civil rights leaders and people who were not necessarily civil rights leaders per se, but people like Vernon Jordan, who was such a great friend of Bill Clinton's, but also used to be the president of the Urban League. We don't do as much anymore because we've come a long way, and I think that's what Barack Obama has been trying to say, and that's what he's been trying to say to Reverend Wright. Yes, there are tremendous injustices, but look how far we have come. Not far enough. Not far enough. We are not waving any flags, but the fact that out of a panel of four on The View, four of them are women, two of them are black, I'm not sure that we would have done that 20 years ago. I'm not sure we would even have done it 12 years ago. And now we are colorblind in that program. I mean, we know it, obviously. But they are both wonderful, and neither one of them were picked for their color.
Let's come back to this section. The lady in the red jacket there towards under the spotlight, yeah.
By the way, thank you for talking about TMZ, because they are a horror.
Thank you, Barbara, for coming to Philadelphia. We are glad you are on the top of the list. Of the people that
just walked out, are you with TMZ? Good. That's what I mean about nothing being private. So you never know when there's a camera and a microphone.
Of all the people that you have interviewed in your whole life, could you tell us who are the three people that you would have wanted to really be a friend and why?
Three people I would want to have been my friend?
That you would have wanted to be their friend
and
why?
Friend. Well, you know, some of them are so august that you wouldn't, they wouldn't necessarily have your friends. Certainly the Dalai Lama, you know, I interviewed him. We did a program, a special, a couple of years ago called Heaven, Where Is It and How Do You Get There? And I can tell you. And we went to Dharamsala to do an interview with him. And his presence and his warmth. He said, we have interviewed almost every leaders in almost every religion who talked about the way to get into heaven and so on. And he said that what the most important thing in life was. And he said the most important thing in life is to be happy. And the way to happiness is warm-heartedness and compassion. It would be wonderful to have this man always as a friend and as a mentor. A lot of them, other people I've talked to, I can't say that I've become intimate with, Christopher Reeve and Dana Reeve. I have a chapter on celebrities who affected my life. I did the first interview with Christopher Reeve and the last. How can you not have admired what this man did with his life and what Dana did with her life? I have to pick a third. I think that there are people, for example, who I love to be with, whom I could interview again in the end just because they're always fresh. Bette Midler, Cher. I have the same birthday as Michael Douglas and Catherine Zeta-Jones, and we celebrate birthdays together. But for the most part, people I interview, some I like, some I don't like, but we don't become too, you know, you do the interview and that's kind of it. You don't become close personal friends. I could go through others, I think, but those are the names that just kind of come very quickly.
This young lady here in the line. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
We have two lines.
Oh, we have two lines. I was actually pointing to the blonde.
Well, we'll take after.
Okay. Real fast. Have you ever been concerned about your physical safety, personal safety,
I have no, somehow or other, I have no fear when I'm doing a story. I mean, I interviewed Saddam Hussein in the middle of the Iran war. I just don't seem to have any, I have fears in my personal life, but somehow or other when I'm working, I don't, and I don't know why. I don't know. I'm fortunate that I don't. I don't pray all the time, but I pray on a plane every time I get on. Not just for me, all the other passengers I know they're for are safe.
Right. Now
we have the other line lady.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Hello. Tamla, I watch for every morning. Great.
Thank you.
Barbara, years ago, somebody was interviewing you, and you talked about an interview with a man who you were nervous, and he said to you, you should always be viewed on your left profile.
Laurence Olivier.
There you go.
Laurence Olivier, how's that for name dropping? Laurence Olivier, when I did an interview with him, which was a wonderful interview, I asked him, what he thought of himself, the man who was considered the greatest actor in the English-speaking world. And he said, I'm a workman. And I said, you're a workman? Then I'll tell you about the face. And he said, well, yes, an actor is a workman. A poet is a workman. God is a workman. Thank you, Laurence Olivier, okay? And then he said, which is your best side? And I said, I haven't a clue. And he said, your left side.
Wonderful. Unfortunately, that will have to be the last question. Barbara Walters will be here a little while longer, I believe, signing some books, but two things you should know. Unfortunately, given time constraints, she can't personalize them or take pictures. Obviously, there's a lot of people to try.
Unless they're from my left side.
Okay. But let's give her a round of applause. An amazing life, an amazing book.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.